Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
And today we are delighted to be joined by Molly Baz. Molly is an American food writer known for her work at Bon Appetit, where she was senior food editor. Molly has accrued a cult following for her uncomplicated big flavour recipes. And her first book, Cook This Book, teaches you how to be a smarter, faster, more creative cook. Molly, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Molly, as listeners know, we always start this podcast with the same question, which is, what are your earliest memories of food?
I wish I could say that I remember being like 2 years old and like eating yogurt or something and having like a revelatory experience, but I really can't. So I don't know what my earliest memories of food are, but I can say that like I had a light, there was definitely like a light bulb moment for me. There have been several throughout my life. And interestingly, two of them both occurred in Italy on totally separate occasions. But I recall being in Italy like when I was like 18. And I was, of course, already into food. But I went into this little trattoria in Orvieto and I had a like large plate of truffled pasta. And I just remember being like collapsed on the floor in awe of how delicious it was. And I think that was like one of the moments where I was like, oh, I'm like really into food. This like does something to me. And it happened in Italy again, like a year or so later when I was studying abroad, living with this woman, Graziella, in her homestay. And she would put just like the most delicious but simple and restrained food on the table for dinner every night. And again, I was just like, this is like different than whatever's was happening when I grew up and is different than the food that I'm used to eating in America. And it just kind of like changed things for me. So not super young age, but like I do recall a few like very formative meals that I had in my like young adult life that then sort of like set the table for my career.
And before those meals, were you cooking at all? Or was it like literally a Damascene moment of food?
Was cooking a little bit, like was just kind of starting to get into it. But it really wasn't until college that I like was like, this is what I'm doing. I went to college actually for art history at Skidmore. And I finished out my degree, but was basically very, very set on moving straight into a career in food after I graduated. And that's what I did. Like, I graduated on, I don't know what it was, like May 30th. And the next day, I went and got a job in a restaurant and have been in food and not in art history ever since.
And just to take you back slightly, Molly, what were mealtimes like when you were growing up with your family?
My parents are going to listen to this and think that I'm not giving them enough credit, but let's see, the most distinct meals that I remember, that like meals that we had on repeat that were just like things that passed through our kitchen all the time. Chicken cutlets, frozen peas, because I guess we would rather eat them frozen than steamed or boiled or however else my mom would have prepared them. So we ate them frozen, which was such a weird thing to just eat like ice cold hard peas in the middle of a meal. Swedish meatballs, buttered noodles, pot roast, meatloaf, like very like humble American foods. My mom did a lot of the cooking growing up, but she wasn't like ever, it was never her passion. It's not like, I didn't like grow up in a family that was just like going to the farmer's market every day and like making feasts like on Sundays. It just wasn't like that. I kind of like found my love for food separately actually. But my parents have gotten a lot more into food and cooking since then. And my dad has gotten super into it. So I think also like times have changed and like the whole world is like really into food in a different way now than it was growing up, or at least in America. So they've sort of evolved with it. But yeah, I didn't really grow up in a foodie household at all.
And what about, we often ask about school food because British school food has a reputation for being formative in a not good way. Mm-hmm. did you eat at school or did you take your own lunches? Was it something as traumatic as we have here or not.
So I went to public school up until fourth grade, and then I transferred to a private school. And I don't really remember the meals from public school, but I do remember that in private school, we had, and this was like a pretty small school, we had a I think it was a vegetarian, health-forward caterer that would come in and cooked the lunches. So it was like, they were like on retainer to be like our lunch service. And so it was a lot of like hippy dippy shit. And I don't remember, I don't recall it being particularly delicious or particularly offensive, but as we got older at that school, we were allowed to go off campus for lunch. And so like, as soon as I could, I did that. And this is like so embarrassing for me to admit, but like my lunch order was on the regular was either a everything bagel with scallion cream cheese toasted, followed by a cinnamon raisin bagel with butter. So like back-to-back bagels for lunch would have been my first choice. My second choice would have been a sausage, egg, and cheese from this deli that was like right off campus, like just the dirtiest like sausage, egg, and cheese you can imagine. And then the third thing that I loved, this is really bringing me back, was a sandwich from Quiznos. Do you guys have Quiznos? Do you know what that is? It's like Subway. It's just like a sub chain, a sub shop chain. That their like whole thing was like they make their subs hot. So like whereas most sub spots did like cold sandwiches, they like put their sandwiches through this machine that like melts the cheese and toasts the bread. And I loved the sandwich there that was the turkey bacon guacamole, which now just like kind of grosses me out. But yeah, I guess all that to say, like in high school or like in middle school and high school, like I liked food. I knew what I wanted, but my mind wasn't very like I didn't have an expansive like knowledge of food. And so that's something that I really have fostered in the like 10 or so years since.
And how about at college? You're at Skidmore College, New York. What was food like there?
I was always known as the girl in the cafeteria who would like whip up the cool meals, like you know, like the dining hall at Skidmore, you could like make your own omelet. There was like a station where you could make your own omelet, and they had like all the chopped veggies and then the eggs and the cheese and whatever. And I would always like do like a few laps around the dining hall first and like look at everything that was happening on all the stations and then figure out like what's the best thing I can make out of this using the flat top griddle at where the omelet station is. So I would like take things from other parts of of the dining hall and kind of just like cook my own food. Because at that point, so people were always like, they would like, if they would come to the dining hall with me, they'd always be like, just make me whatever you're making. And I would like create a meal on like the flat top in the dining hall. So I kind of took it and ran with it. But the dining hall was good at Skidmore. I mean, they had good options. Lots to work with.
And your year out in Italy, was that with food in mind? Or was that purely, did you just end up in Italy because of the course you were doing?
Because of the course I was doing. Skidmore had a program over there for art history, and I was studying Renaissance art at the time. And so I went to Florence. There was no better place for it. But I was already, you know, like I was already starting to have an interest in food. But I certainly don't think I thought my career would be in it, but I was already like at the point of my life where food was something like I thought about a lot and was like that I sought out whenever I went to new places. And so I did spend a lot of my time there eating my way through Florence and like thinking about how that was going to change my life forever.
Molly, what were the classic Florentine dishes you brought home with you?
There's actually a recipe in my book called Graziella's Pasta al Pomodoro, and that is the tomato sauce that Graziella, my homestay mother who was a widow, made like probably once a week. And so that dish for me is like iconic, and representative of my time in Florence. I don't necessarily know if it was a meal that you would have had out. I think it was like a little bit untraditional that her pasta sauce was made with cherry tomatoes. But so that one sticks with me as like an iconic dish that I will forever associate with my time there. And then there was this panini shop on the other side of the river. And I don't remember what it was called, but I remember they had this eggplant, mozzarella, arugula, like pressed panini, like pretty classic, nothing crazy. That was just like the most delicious thing I'd ever had. And I ate it so many times. And then I also had a crush on the guy who worked there, who was like the chef at the panini shop. So that's the other thing in Florence. That, like, when I go back, I'm going straight to that panini shop.
So you mentioned earlier that you graduated on a Monday and you were looking for restaurant jobs on a Tuesday. Do you remember when that decision to pursue a restaurant or a food career crystallized for you?
Yeah, so I graduated early from college. Like, I had done a bunch of courses in high school that got me enough credits such that I was able to graduate 6 months early. And instead of going home or going off with and moving on with my life, I stayed up in Saratoga Springs and waited until everyone else graduated. And I lived up there and I turned my house into a restaurant on the weekends. And so I did like the supper club thing that was like hot back then, where like you pretend you're a chef and like have an intimate dinner party and turn your house into a restaurant. And it was with my best friend, Michaela. She was also really into food. And so we just spent the last semester of college like kind of just like playing chef, I would say. And it was so fun. Like, I just enjoyed it so much. And I think that's when I was like, okay, I can do this in a real way when I leave college, and like, it doesn't need to be in my living room anymore.
And what were your early jobs like in restaurants?
Well, so the first job I got, like right after graduating college, was at the Beacon Hill Bistro in Boston. And I to this day do not know why the chef, Jason Bond, hired me. Like, I was not up to snuff, that's for sure. I guess, like, he saw something in me, or he must have, because I definitely was not, like, ready to be working on the line. But he put me, like, on day one, he put me on the roast station, which is a hot station where, like, you're picking up, like, the chicken and the pork and the steak and whatever. And the pasta. It was also the pasta station. So he just, like, normally you would go, like, to garde-manger, which is where you make the cold salads. And, like, that's, like, your entry into a professional, like, French-style kitchen. But he just, like, hired me and put me on roast. And I remember I was sort of, like, trailing for the job. And tickets were coming in. And I was trailing whoever was on that station. And there was, like, three chickens in the oven. And they were, like, grab the chickens. And I was like, where's the pot holder? Like, how do I grab the chicken? The skillet is fucking so hot. And they were like, where's your side towel? And I was like, what is a side towel? Like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, someone get me a freaking oven mitt. And that's when I was like, oh, you really just have no fucking clue what you're doing here. And now, you know, side towels are basically like an extension of me, but I learned really quickly. Like, it was a steep learning curve, and it was difficult, but I really enjoyed the challenge. And I just felt like every day I was just learning so much. And I made a very conscious decision not to go to culinary school, because I was convinced that I can get the exact same education, if not a better one, while working in restaurants and getting paid like a little bit versus paying a lot for the same education and being like, you know, out $40,000 at the end of it. So yeah, I really treated that year as like my culinary education, and I worked there for a year and then moved on to working in restaurants in New York City, which like then spanned a whole slew of things from like super, super fine dining, Michelin starred restaurant, which was a whole nother kind of boot camp, to like a more casual Middle Eastern restaurant and a British gastropub in Brooklyn. And so I just, you know, spent a couple of years like making my way around the New York City restaurant circuit until I burned out.
Is there lots of pressure working in a restaurant?
Yeah, I mean, definitely working at Picheline was so intense. I mean, I would never go back to that time, but I also was like younger and really eager and okay with being treated like shit. But yeah, it was, perfection was like so important. And it was, I think I was like, there was one other girl who worked in the kitchen, but she worked like pastry. And besides that, it was just me and a bunch of dudes and like, a, you know, 20 very hot burners and 1 million tickets coming in all the time. And so like, I really had to like prove myself there. And I feel like I did, which like I am very proud of. And I think my time there was super successful because I sort of like made my way down the line, meaning like up the ranks. But yeah, it was like not a great work environment. A lot of like verbal abuse, but I just never really let it get to me. I was always able to sort of like step away from it.
And tell us about how you moved from restaurants into recipe development and food writing.
So I burned out on restaurants and just, you know, no one else in my life, except for the people who I worked in restaurants with, was on that kind of schedule and like living the lifestyle. And my days off were Mondays and Tuesdays. And I loved cooking more than anything, but like felt like I just like didn't have a life. And so I started getting into, I met a woman who had like a private chef and catering company in Brooklyn, and we kind of like ended up partnering up. Her name was Amanda Elliott. And so I was a private chef with her for a while for different clients in the city. I was like, I'm going to try this on. You know, it was really fun to like have like a partner in crime to do it all. And we had our little business that was great for a time, but ultimately that didn't feel right either because, you know, when clients are paying you to be their personal chef, you're really like at their beck and call, and your opinions about like what tastes good and your creativity kind of get squashed for their needs. And so I just felt really stifled by that. Like I was like, I'm not cooking my food. I'm cooking like for this really specific diet and this really particular needs of this family, and this isn't me. And so then I was like, you know, I've always loved food publications. Like Gourmet magazine growing up was just like the most important piece of literature for me. And so I always like in the back of my mind was like, I'm going to get into food media, and definitely did not know what food media meant even. I just was like, I know that's a thing. There's magazines and it's like a media thing and I'm going to do it. And it was always, always, always a dream to work at what would have been at Gourmet until they folded, and then at Bon Appetit. And I certainly never in a million years would ever, ever, ever have thought that I would have gotten a job at Bon Appetit. And still, I'm still sort of flabbergasted by it, even now that I'm like out the other end in a totally different way. But I ended up, you know, starting to dip my toe into food styling. I have a friend, Nora Singley, who is a food stylist, and I started assisting her. So I was sort of like skirting around food media by being on photo shoots for magazines or cookbooks or whatever we were shooting at the time. And then I sort of started to like branch out on my own as a food stylist. And at the same time, started getting into recipe testing, which is a part of the food industry that I think many people don't even know exists, but is at least for Bon Appetit and Epicurious, which are sister brands, a very important part of the process of creating a magazine and developing recipes. And it's a freelance position oftentimes where you just go in to oftentimes your own kitchen or go into a test kitchen at a magazine, and you test someone else's recipes, you know, by the book. So someone will have developed a recipe, they'll have worked on it a couple of times, they get it to a place that's really good, one of the editors, and then they would pass it on to me, and I would cook through it just like start to finish and follow the recipe. And at the end of the recipe, I would present it to them and be like, here were all of like my hiccups, my timing didn't line up with yours, I actually ended up having to use 3 tablespoons of olive oil instead of 1 because it was sticking to the pan. And you like mark up the recipe and return it to the developer, and then they make edits and tweaks. And that's how you get to like a really sound recipe that has been tested in more places than one and by more people than one. And so that was really intriguing to me. And I started recipe testing on a freelance basis at Epicurious, which is the sister brand to Bon Appetit. And I remember the feeling of going into the World Trade Center, into the Epicurious test kitchen, which was pretty small relative to the Bon Appetit one down the hall, but I'm being like, I'm like I'm doing it. I'm in, like, I'm on the precipice of something here. Like, I'm in the halls of the dream. So, like, whatever you have to do to stay here, just, like, make it work. And so just made myself really available to being a recipe tester at Epicurious. And then as they relied on me more, I was also doing more food styling. So I started doing food styling for them and ended up going in-house as a food stylist for all of the video across Bon Appetit and Epicurious. And so I wasn't a food editor yet, but I was basically helping style and set up the segments for the YouTube channel that then later blew up into what most people know as Bon Appetit, even though we also make a magazine. And that was sort of like the way I started to touch Bon Appetit was by styling. And I had a lot of free time on my hands because this was a new role. The video department wasn't like super big at the time. And so we weren't shooting every single day. And I had more time than I knew what to do with. And I was just like sitting around the World Trade Center. So I went into the Bon Appetit test kitchen and was like, if you guys want me to test recipes or like help you out in any way, like I have free time, I'm happy to do it. And that was how I sort of like made myself available to the team at the Bon Appetit test kitchen. And then ultimately when a position opened up, was able to take a job there as a food editor. And I hadn't been on video at all. I had always been behind the scenes, always like food styling or something, you know, supportive as like on the back end. And then like a week or so after transitioning into my role as food editor at Bon Appetit, the video team, which I had been working for, was like, do you want to be on camera now? And I was like, yes, please. and I was so fucking nervous. I think my first video was like they had me develop a recipe for Eggs Benedict for a crowd, and I shot that like 2 weeks after starting that job. And then that was really at the time that like the Bon Appetit YouTube channel was taking off. And then the rest was kind of history. It just like kind of spiraled out of control from there in terms of like the growth of that part of the brand and my participation in video. And yeah, and that was my job as a food editor.
You've recently left Bon Appetit. Can you walk us through what exactly happened there?
I mean, this would be a whole nother podcast to get into, but ultimately, like this summer, a lot was revealed about sort of like the toxic workplace that is Bon Appetit, and there were pay inequities and there, you know, there's a lot that was revealed this summer through a slew of events. And I ultimately made the decision to leave because I felt like there were parts of the brand that weren't growing, that weren't going to evolve and change in the way that I felt they needed to in terms of like creating an equitable workplace without, you know, and sort of abolishing the racist system that was in place in terms of talent and all of that. And, you know, but, and I also felt that like there are so few positions at Bon Appetit and there are such highly coveted roles. And I knew that like ultimately it was going to be part of my journey to leave Bon Appetit. I didn't think it was going to happen as soon as it did. But I felt like I needed to stand in solidarity with my colleagues who were really fighting for good contracts and weren't getting them. And it was important to me to stand up for them. But also by leaving, I knew that I was opening up a position at the brand that could then be offered to someone else, ideally a non-white female such as myself, to provide an opportunity to someone who hadn't had the chance and deserved a chance to work at Bon Appetit. I felt like it became very clear how privileged I was to be in the position I was, and it was sort of like time to let someone else take that role. And so the decision was, like, there was a lot that went into it. My book was also about to launch, which is imminent now. And I knew that I had a lot of work to do for that. And so I left and went out on my own. It was kind of scary, but it felt like it was the right thing to do. And I'm just in a whole nother world now. Like, it just went like this from, I can't even believe how quickly things have evolved to this point where now I just work for myself. But it's cool and fun and challenging in a different way.
And tell us a bit about the book. So this is Cook This Book. It's your first cookbook. Tell us about the book, but also a little bit about your cooking style, because fans of you will know exactly the kind of thing you make, but there might be spectator listeners who aren't familiar with your food. So tell us about that.
So there's 100 recipes in the book, and they are the whole concept of the book is to really provide an education, like in the fundamentals and the techniques, the building blocks of cooking. And so the recipes are really jam-packed with information to help support and sort of like illuminate some of the whys of cooking. I feel like what recipes traditionally do is just sort of like instruct you and just say like, do this, do that, do this, do that. But they don't say like, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? This is why I'm asking you to do this. This is why I'm asking you to do that. And so that is sort of like what I wanted to do with this book, is like anticipate the questions that a novice cook would have and answer them before they have them in the text of the book, so that they're really like taking something away from each recipe. So it's really a book in techniques and in fundamentals. And I never know how to describe my food. Like, people ask me this all the time. I honestly feel like I need to ask someone else to like describe what my food is, so that I can have a like a one-liner when people ask me this question. I think it's just like hard to get out of your own head and get a perspective on it. But the recipes are pretty simple. Like, it was very important to me that I never call for a hard to find ingredient. I wanted it for the most part all to be accessible from just like a regular ass grocery store. Just, you know, the whole book is basically just like a massive love letter to the novice cook. And just like, it's my way of saying like, I see you and I know how hard it is to cook. I know how easy it is to just be like, ugh, whatever. I just can't. I'm not going to do that. That's asking too much. I don't have those ingredients. I don't know where to get them. There's too many ingredients. There's too many steps. Like, I just want my readers to know that like, I see you and I feel you, and this book is for you, because all of these recipes are with you specifically in mind and not me. Like, these aren't recipes for me. These are recipes for you guys. So yeah, that's the book. That's my food. The photography was shot by Peden and Monk, who have always been for me like the creme de la creme of food photographers in New York City. So when they agreed to this project, I was like totally flabbergasted. And I love the photographs so much. They feel very me. Like, I really feel like they captured my personality in the photographs. And then the book, I mean, this is a podcast so no one can see this, but the book is designed by a French graphic design team named Violaine et Jeremy, who have a type foundry in Paris and have done lots of graphic work, but like only one other cookbook. But I had followed them, and my husband was a fan of theirs, and he was like, we should ask them if they'll do your book. And it was like kind of a weird thing to ask, because they're French and they don't really specialize in cookbooks, but I think they did an amazing job, and I'm kind of obsessed with the way it's designed. So that's the book.
When did you decide to put the videos into the book?
Right at the beginning. It was an idea that spurred from a conversation I had with my friend Declan, who has remained a close friend and has been very involved in this book in different ways. I can't recall exactly the conversation, but we basically were just on the phone, and I was like talking him through like what I was getting after in this book, and like how I was writing the recipes, and we were kind of just like, what if there could be more? Like, it's so crazy to me that cookbooks are so singular, in the sense that they, like, we live in such a multimedia world and like such a digital world, but cookbooks are just like floating out here on their own, which is amazing and special because they're like physical and nothing can really replace that. But it just felt like a lost opportunity to not bridge the gap between a physical book and the internet, which is where most of us spend 99% of our time. And I obviously, you know, I know that my followers, a lot of them know me primarily through my videos and not because of my work for Bon Appetit magazine, the magazine. And so I felt like, okay, this is a way to sort of like speak to that fan base and give them more of what they're used to seeing, which is me teaching them how to cook on camera. But like, let's integrate that into the book. And I really just don't understand why no one's ever done it before. Like, it feels like a bit of a game changer to me, because you can just bring to life a recipe or a technique or whatever it is in such a different way in video, but you also can like maintain the like specialness of a physical cookbook.
And just to explain to listeners, you have a QR code in the book, which if you scan it, it directs you to a video on your website or on...
Yeah, it's hosted on my website and just pops up. And it teaches you a technique, whatever technique is called for in the recipe.
As you say, we spend most of our time on the internet. I'm sure, Olivia, I would feel the same as you do. Do you think more broadly that the internet has been good for food and social media has been good for food?
Yes and no. I mean, I think it's incredible resource in terms of, like, I wouldn't know half of what I know about food if the internet didn't exist. So I guess yes, I would say yes. I think, you know, the internet is also a dark place, and I think that goes for every industry, but I think that you have such access to food and to recipes from like cultures and cuisines that you might not otherwise be familiar with or have access to just like in your physical whereabouts, that I think it's pretty incredible for like expanding cuisine.
We're recording this at the end of March 2021. We've globally had a weird year, the past year. Depending on where you've been for the past year, many of us haven't been able to eat in the places we might have done or eat in the way that we did before. How has the last year been for you from a food point of view? What have you been eating at home?
A lot of people, I think, like assume that... Like, I think that everyone feels really burnt out from cooking, and I don't. And I feel, like, sorry to say that, because, like, I just love cooking so much that, like, I don't feel, like, burnout. It's definitely something that happens, and, like, when that happens, I do takeout. And I try and, you know, like, support restaurants that I love that are around me. I mean, I live in LA, so it's easy for me to get any kind of food at any moment. But it's like I cook for a living and I also cook for pleasure. And so this year has just been a lot more of that, which for me has been actually really incredible. So I guess like it just doesn't feel that different, because when I was going into an office at Bon Appetit, I would cook all day in a kitchen anyway. Like my life is in a kitchen, whether that be home or at Bon Appetit at the test kitchen or a restaurant or whatever it is. And when I would get home from work to my home kitchen, I would also cook dinner. So like, we're just doing the same thing that I'm just doing the same thing I've always done, just like all happening in one place now, I guess I would say.
And Molly, what for you is comfort food?
Comfort food, the ultimate, like my always Sunday, like I am lazy and I want to be cozy and just have like the perfect... like end of weekend meal is just always a roast chicken, which I think sounds cliched, but maybe there's a reason. I mean, roast chickens are just perfect and delicious and so simple. I think that people like get really intimidated by it, but for me, it's actually the most hands-off easy thing I could throw together with the greatest results. So I will always, like, if you ask me what I want as like the most, as a comforting meal, like, or just really any time, I'm just probably going to say a roast chicken.
And on a similar vein of favorites, what's your desert island meal?
Desert island, when you say desert island, actually, do you mean like last meal on earth? Or do you mean like, what am I foraging for on an island?
No. Death row meal without sounding as bleak as that. I think that's what we're going for.
Okay.
No foraging needed.
Okay, cool. Because I was like, I don't know if I'll find Parmesan cheese on an island. my all-time favorite meal, the last meal I'd like to have on Earth, I would like to start with oysters and shrimp cocktail. And then I would like to transition into a Caesar salad. And then from there, I would have a roast chicken and some kind of like crispy smashed potato, or probably not a French fry, probably like a smashed and crispy potato and some delicious wine. And I don't even think I would want dessert. Like, I think I would want to go out on a savory note.
Well, you can do that.
Because it's my meal.
Molly, thank you so much for joining Table Talk. And Molly's book, Cook This Book, is out now and published by Little Brown.
Thank you for listening. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, please do subscribe. And if you've really enjoyed it, please do leave us a star rating and review. It really helps us out.